And welcome to the Zeta Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I always say that you can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, and you can check us on the web at Taylor-Report.com. And with me is Phil Conlon.
Hi, yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to talk to two really interesting people. There are stories moving about as we speak. One is, of course, we have Occupy Toronto. And there's been a column written by the sort of cultural cop at the Globe, putting down some of the people there, and she named one. This is Margaret Wynne. We're very fortunate. We're going to talk to the woman she named, who turns out that she writes a better column, actually. And a matter of fact, once you go and look it up, it's ms.marks.blogspot.com. Really smart stuff. The people who write to Ms.Marks are somewhat more literate and educated than what we found on that column in the Globe. Although there's an excellent piece in the Globe today, letter saying, you know, you have to hand it to Margaret Wynne. She, there are not many people who really have the courage to run to the side of the rich and powerful, rather than the other side. And so she gets credit for that. So we're going to talk to Laurel O'Gorman, and that'll be in a few minutes. And then later in the show, we're going to talk to the spokesperson for the Canadian boat Gaza. There's been dramatic development, and people here are very impressed, I think, at the courage and determination of those Canadians who now, for a number of years, actually, been part of this effort to bring medicine and other necessaries to the small democratic state of Gaza. That small democracy, of course, is not recognized by our government and nor by the U.S. government. But there are people all over the world who care and who are actually, by their actions, helping to work toward a peaceful resolution of the crisis that the people of Gaza live under. So that we will be talking to, that would be Dennis O'Keefe, and we expect that'll be around 5:30. I'm going to, we have a couple of items. We want to make sure we tell you about things that are going on. Phil, you have one at Beth Satoon, I think.
Yes, and Beth Satoon will be having an event this Friday at 7 p.m. called Under Construction, The Politics of Walls in Palestine and Beyond. And they have three academics from York University are going to be talking on this subject. It's in the context of the International Week Against the Wall in Palestine. This panel will look at the local and global dimensions of separation dynamics in Palestine, Cyprus, and Spain, Morocco. And that's this Friday evening, November the 11th at 7 p.m., Beit Zetun, 612 Markham Street, right by Markham and Bloor, a very convenient location. And it's $5 or more admission at the door. Doors open at 10 minutes to 7. And they are having a related event on next Monday, a week from tonight, so that kind of fits in with our calendar here, at 7 p.m. Monday, November 14th. And that is called Palestine Occupied, Living at the Wall, Perspectives by Israeli and Palestinian Activists. And we'll have Zogby Zogby, a Palestinian Christian and Executive Director of We On Peace Center in Bethlehem. That's next Monday at 7 p.m. at Beit Zetun. So there's two good events, one Friday and one Monday at Beit Zetun.
The date is? Did you say the date?
The date is Monday the 14th and Friday the 11th.
Beit Zetun is, yes. They do a lot of great stuff. And this item, I think, would probably be, we should read this right away, actually. This is from, we interviewed David Heap.
We did.
Sometime back. And I kept having a problem because I kept mentioning, saying Dan, who we all knew and loved, and Dan is now a senior experiencing some difficulties, and he's made, there's been a discussion of his status and what happens to the elderly and the type of care and all that. And so, but when we spoke to David, I kept wanting to call him Dan. Well, David is one of the leaders in this effort, Canadian Boat to Gaza. And we have, this is written, just this is brand new. I write to you from cell 9 of the apartheid state of Israel. Dear sisters and brothers, friends and loved ones, I write to you from cell 9, Block 59, Givon Prison, near Ramla in occupied Palestine. Although I was tasered, and I haven't seen that in the Toronto Star, I was tasered during the assault on the Tahrir and bruised during forcible removal dockside. I'm limping slightly as a result. I am basically okay. We, Ahab, Michael, Karen, and Tahrir, as well as Karen, Kit of the U.S., and Jihan, who we saw briefly this morning. That's who the party is. We are most concerned about our shipmate, Palestinian Majid Kayal from Haifa, last seen by us at Ashdod being photographed and put in a police car. By the way, there's an asterisk to that. We're informed that Majid Kayal has been released. We'll learn more of that later, I hope. Although Michael and I, among others, were transported in handcuffs and leg shackles, let me stress that we are neither criminals nor illegal immigrants, but rather political prisoners of the apartheid state of Israel. Four from the Tahrir are imprisoned with 12 Irish comrades. By the way, Phil, how do you pronounce that? Swasi? Swarsi? The Irish word?
Well, like most Irish Americans, I can't pronounce a word of the Irish language. The British made sure that we didn't learn a word.
I embarrassed. Here's my good Irish friend, and I did that to you. I apologize. So, a boat with an Irish name, who have been more experienced with such issues. The four of us, Ahab and I, Canadians, Michael of Australia, and Hassan of UK, United Kingdom, have joined with the Irish in their political prisoners committee in order to press our collective demands. By the way, we'll do a whole program someday about why it is the Irish know more about your rights in prison than a lot of other people. They are association, they are demanding association in the block, that is open cells, adequate writing and reading material, free communication with the outside world, that is regular phone calls, information about shipmate women held at the same prison. We add one Tahrir-specific demand, that Israeli state recognize the professional status of Democracy Now! Journalist Jihan Hafez in accordance with her credentials from the U.S. government. All political incarceration is unjust, but let me stress that in duration and condition, our situation pales in comparison to the plight of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners and the open-air prison of Gaza. If you have energy to devote to solidarity actions in the coming days, please concentrate on them. We must get Tahrir back and hope freedom waves continue. Free Majid Kayal, free all political prisoners, free Gaza, free Palestine. Stay human, in love and struggle, David. That's David Heap. And we're going to be asking a spokesperson if we can get further updates. But it's great to get the actual message of the man involved in this, one of them. I do know from Democracy Now! Of this AM that their correspondent was made to put her hands over her head and to get on her knees and to be treated basically as just another prisoner. When in fact, she is a journalist, she is an accredited journalist, she had all of her documents there available. She was not part of one of the activists, she's simply on the boat. But, other details that I've heard about, they pointed guns at them all. I mean, this is all just an exercise. You want to remember, we're dealing with a government that actually tries to suggest they're all terrorists. People forget the argument of Mr. Netanyahu. I've listened to him talk. To him, this is all part of a terrorist operation, which is one of the reasons 9 people on the Turkish boat of a year ago were killed, because that's how they defined who they were dealing with. It actually scares them to be dealing with peaceful people. They don't really know quite what to do. They have to turn them into something really dangerous.
Which, by the way, they did with Rachel Corrie, the young woman who was a pacifist who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer a couple of years ago, an American woman. Mm-hmm. And they still to this day talk about her as if she was some sort of person who was a real danger to the state of Israel.
She's the problem.
Yeah.
And that's the ugly things that we have to deal with.
By the way, I have to say that letter you just read from Mr. Heap, the Israelis told the Toronto Star, who didn't bother to check and see if they were right about it, that we're just going to hold them for a day or two and send them packing on their way back to their home countries and repay them. There's nothing to worry about, right? And, of course, that letter tells a very, very different story from what the Star thought was the end of the story. You know.
That's why we do community radio. That's why you have alternative radio, is so that you can actually not be only talked about. You can talk back. And David Heap is talking back, which he has every right and responsibility to do. And thank heaven we can go in there and do this. Yes, the Toronto Star ran a headline with quotes around the words. It said, people on the Gaza boat, quote, roughed up, they claim. Well, now we're learning that they were tasered. Tasered is pretty rough. There's a guy at the Vancouver airport got tasered and died. He was a middle-aged Polish gentleman trying to visit his mother, but since he didn't speak English properly, they tasered him and he's dead. So, that's the kind of phenomenon we're dealing with. But anyway, our hats are off to David Heap and to the others of the Gaza boat. We'll be later in the program talking to a spokesperson who's located in Vancouver. Now, to go back to the Occupy Toronto and the article, that piece was, as we have argued, is poorly written and highly biased. But it did lead to an excellent piece by the person who was being talked about, and her name is Laurel O'Gorman, and I believe she's on the line. Are you there, Laurel?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Laurel. How are you?
Hi, I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good. Many people were appalled at the piece written by Margaret Wendt, and always when these things happen, you say, well, she has a very powerful national paper, and people talked about usually just have to play the victim and don't get to reply. But you have a website, if I've got it right, ms.marks.blogspot.com. Am I right?
Yes.
Hey, that's and incidentally, you yourself have written a couple of good columns. I hope you keep on writing, because it's good we have a dialogue. Now, let's start with she somewhat mischaracterized who you were. Is that right?
I think she did, yes. She just looked at an article that was published a couple weeks ago in the Globe and saw the word single mother, and it seems as though she assumed I was kind of, I guess, the welfare mom stereotype is what seems to keep coming up.
Uh-huh. By the way, she made no effort to actually talk to you, did she? I mean, you say she was working from somebody else's, from something that had been written.
Yes.
Elsewhere.
No effort to contact me whatsoever.
And how did you happen? Let's go to that. You attended, you were in Toronto at the Occupy Toronto. And what brought you there, and what was going on? Because we've seen a lot of reporting, and I don't think you have been impressed with the quality of the reporting.
A group from Laurentian University in Sudbury, we got a bus together, and we took the bus up to Occupy Toronto for the first days, partially in support of Occupy Toronto and partially as an educational-type experience to be able to start up an Occupy Sudbury here at home.
Oh.
And I was interviewed by a Globe and Mail reporter while I was there.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I was struck by was that, and she and others do this, they have started talking as though the demonstrators are almost all students of sociology. And Phil Conlon is here with me, by the way. He was there the other day. I don't know. Who is there? When you go around and talk to people, who are they and what are their concerns?
when I was there, there were a lot of university educated people there, but there were a lot of people who weren't university students as well.
Mm-hmm.
Occupy Sudbury has mostly they're people who live in poverty. There's a lot of homeless people. There's people who used to be accountants. There's a retired chiropractor. Like, there's people from all walks of life. And I found the same thing in Occupy Toronto.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, you're thinking of Occupy Sudbury. By the way, culturally, Sudbury is a very special kind of town. You would be rather like Oakland, wouldn't you?
You would think. Not as much as I would hope.
Yes, you might.
Occupy Sudbury has been going for a couple weeks now. So.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize that. The national media didn't share that with us.
Really?
Well, are you getting now? Apropos of that point, I saw Sid Ryan and some other union folks have been to Occupy Toronto. Are the union people attending in Sudbury?
The steelworkers are very supportive. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
There's representatives from the steelworkers there on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a couple of CUPE members there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they are attending. They don't tend to be camping out, but they're there.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder if we're going to see this phenomenon that, you know, in America they're having a real problem with their Occupy in that now they're discovering there's a lot of veterans who are looking for work and who are seem to be, experiencing a lot of difficulty in life at returning, and we have, of course, in Canada some. I don't know if you've found this, but that will be interesting to see whether Canadian veterans begin to attend.
There's somebody doing research on that in Sudbury right now. There's a political science student who is doing some work on veterans within Occupy Sudbury. I'm not familiar with how many are there, but I know that that is currently being looked at right now.
You know, that's one of the, I'm really glad we're talking to you. By the way, this is Laurel O'Gorman, and she's got a site which I think everybody should get to, ms.marks.blogspot.com. You know, one of the things you emphasize in your article on your site is that we need people who are doing exactly what you just described, telling us who we are and what our income groups are and such things. We get most commentary that most of us rely on is of that type that you were the victim of, the sneering, upper crust kind of commentary with no facts. No factual basis.
Mm-hmm.
You point out that you're a kind of triple threat to Margaret Wendt. What do you mean by that?
Well, she seems to have something against single mothers, and I have two children. I'm currently divorced, so I'm a single mother. She also doesn't seem to like liberal arts majors, or maybe it's just sociology, despite her having a master's degree in English, which I'm sure is very similar to the degree I'm currently working on. And I'm also the president of a union local here on campus. And I've seen time and again that she's not very fond of unions. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, she had the point that she said, well, why don't they study mechanical engineering? And you, of course, doing your research, you have discovered there are mechanical engineers looking for work.
There are, and there are some who have posted on her article saying that they have a degree in engineering and they don't have work. The problem I have with that is she wants us to let the market dictate where we find jobs. But what is the market? How did this market come into existence? Whereas I'm arguing, and this is a sociological standpoint, but we created the market. It's actually not that old. Capitalism has only been around for about 500 years in the way that we know it. And it's not even like a pure form of capitalism because you have a few people with a lot of power making these decisions. And it seems like, in her mind, only the people that have that type of power should get a degree that allows you to think critically about what's actually going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, her assumptions. Thank goodness. Again, you wrote this column, and there is some reply. I wonder what you're thinking about this kind of new situation we're in with media. I mean, you are functioning now. You have a great site, ms.marks.blogspot.com. I mean, in the old days, you know, I should say, a decade or so, you could just get pummeled in the Globe and Mail, and you wouldn't be able to say a word.
Well, you could write a letter and hope it gets published, yes.
Yeah, as one who used to do that, to my frustration.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is a certain empowerment going on here, right? That you're a very trained, excellent writer, and, of course, but the media, you know, the high-paying folks she works for, they've got the commanding heights, and they think, therefore, they have the commanding rights. I mean, you don't get to answer, though you're as well-trained and certainly more broadly trained than she is.
Thank you. No, I don't have my blog delivered to everybody's front doorstep in the morning, so I definitely don't have the same readership that she would have. But it's nice to be able to use some of these tools of capitalism, these things that they created, to take them and to use them against the people who created them for different purposes.
Yeah. By the way, I think I might have misstated. Is it ms-marks.blogspot.com or is it Ms. Dot?
Hyphen.
It's a hyphen.
Ms. Dash Mark.
Yes. Good.
You know, you just beat me there. I feel like I have a hot text from Sudbury telling me to correct that. That it's ms-marks.blogspot.com. So there you go.
By the way, we're all alive here. How about that? So somebody's already commenting on this and getting it, helping us get it straight.
So, Laurel, I want to ask a question about a sociologist. I grew up at a time in the U.S. when sociologists would testify before Senate committees and legislative committees, and their point of view would be taken into account when legislation was being considered, and their opinions and their research would be published in newspapers. Well, a sociologist found this or that, and then I jump forward into the Reagan era, and I remember an uncle of mine who was a sociology professor who was forced to retire prematurely when the university he was at just got rid of the sociology department. What is it with the market people in sociology? What is it that they really hate about it?
Well, in order for people to continue allowing neoliberalism to exist, it really goes against the interests of 99% of the population. So in order for capitalism and in order for the corporate tax cuts for wealthy corporations and things like that to continue to happen, in order for the rich to keep getting richer, the middle class kind of has to be convinced, if you want to... let's say for the sake of argument that there is a middle class, they need to be convinced that poor people are poor because of individual problems. Mm-hmm. And sociology, since at least the 1960s and 70s, and often before that, is consistently saying otherwise. We're consistently pointing out structural or systemic reasons for poverty. We're pointing out systemic hierarchies that exist, racism, sexism, heterosexism, ageism, ableism. And that's not feeding into this neoliberal ideology, which, like I said, if the majority of people started believing some of what we were saying, the wealthy people would not remain wealthy for very long. So I think they need to keep us thinking this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of reminds me. There was the German king who said that if my soldiers would stop and think, I wouldn't have any soldiers.
Exactly.
We're talking to Laurel O'Gorman, and she has a great site, Ms-Marks. I want to make sure we correct that. Ms-Marks.blogspot.com. And you make an excellent point that, in clarifying these issues, that the poor are actually, you say, are treated to shame. Their idea is that the poor should be ashamed of themselves, as the presidential candidate in the States, Mr. Cain, says, you know, you're the reason you have a problem. You know, but the corporations who seem to get a lot of help, they don't seem to be ashamed of themselves.
No, they're not ashamed of their corporate tax breaks at all. Actually, politicians go on TV boasting about $2.4 billion a year in Toronto, or sorry, in Ontario, is now being used for new corporate tax breaks, and this is a good thing. So wealthy corporations are definitely feel entitled to it. And if you think about it, there's more money spent on RRSP deductions for the supposed middle class than there is on social programs for the poor. And you never hear about how those middle-class people are dependent on the system. You never hear about how these corporations are dependent on the system. But you hear about it all the time with, like, the poor single mother who might happen to be getting $900 a month to live off of and raise her family off of. She's a leech off the system. But, you know, those $2.4 billion in corporate tax breaks, those are fine.
Mm-hmm. And another source of all of our economic problems is supposed to be the unions. Now, you're a union leader, and you have some things to say about how well off your members are, particularly compared to management. Could you enlighten us on that?
Well, we are a brand new union. We've only been around for a couple of years and just had our first collective agreement signed this summer. We're graduate teaching assistants. Now, at other campuses across Ontario, the average is about $10,000, sometimes $12,000 a year for graduate teaching assistants. You work 10 hours a week, typically under a professor, grading, sometimes lecturing, a lot of photocopying. Mm-hmm. But you have to have a university degree to get this job. So every person in my local has a bachelor's degree. A lot of them have master's degrees. And we're making about 68% of what they make on average at the in the province. We're the lowest paid GTAs anywhere in the province, and most of us are making about $11 or $12 an hour with our bachelor's degrees. We have no pension, we have no benefits, but apparently being part of a union is part of what's making the university so broke, or making the country so broke, for that matter.
You list among the things that you were able to win as a union group was just to be protected against having to pay out of your own pocket for the materials needed for the day's work, right?
We did a survey when we first organized and found that about 30% of our members had to pay out of pocket for things like textbooks. Some of these are like $150 textbooks. And we were only making $6,900 per year. Mm-hmm. So $150 from that is a really big chunk, just to be able to grade papers. So that is one thing that we put in the collective agreement, is the professor or the department now has to provide the materials for us to grade papers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one of the only things that we've gotten over the past decade. We did manage to get a small raise this year, but it's not on par with the raises that they get at other campuses.
Nor on par with the raises of those who manage, right?
Well, that's what I was about to bring up. In 2003, the president of our university at the time made about $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. The current president of the university last year made $320,000.
Wow.
So
maybe we ought to find out what kind of group he belongs to.
Exactly. And he has a business degree, and I don't think it's any coincidence that the people running universities now have business degrees.
And they give you the business. That's not bad. This is Laurel O'Gorman, and it's ms-marks.blogspot.com. Excellent site. Wonderful reply to the, I would call it, foolish column that in the Globe. Now, I wonder, I know you're looking at all kinds of things. By the way, one of the beauties of having something like Occupy Toronto, Occupy Sudbury, if people get together and discuss where the issues and problems are, I wonder what you think of the attacks against all the Occupy movements. You're coming, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, various others. There's a lot of variety, but are you noticing this kind of, they're all sort of dealing in derivative language? They borrow this term, like they claim you want to be in the virtuocracy. I'm reading that all over the place. Isn't there anybody original in this group? What is the virtuocracy, by the way?
I think that she used it as this new kind of, I guess they're university-educated people who would like to get jobs in, like, government jobs or nonprofit organizations. So basically, they're people that want to help other people but need to, I guess you would say, leech off the system in order to do so.
Yeah, and it's a pejorative, right, that somebody made up, and now all these colonists are using it.
Yes, because the market, as it exists, will not create jobs to help people, because that won't benefit those who are in power. It won't benefit the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to like stigmatize people who are in these helping professions, or stigmatize the individual protesters at the Occupy movement, because if you discredit the messenger, then nobody will listen to the message. And I think that's all she's trying to do, put a couple of faces on a few specific occupiers, try and make them out to seem like villains, and then nobody has to listen to the message.
Mm-hmm. It seems a little dangerous, doesn't it, that they decided to, that they can throw virtue as ballast over the side? Warren Buffett was kind enough to say there is a class war, and my class is winning it. I mean, he's kind of ashamed.
Yes.
I mean, and I should say, he seems to be holding up for virtue itself. He recognizes maybe there's an ethical issue.
Yeah, I guess if you realize that there's an ethical issue, then you can't just sit there and watch people as they sleep on the streets, and you can't see children living in poverty without starting to feel bad about it. And if you feel bad, you might spend less money.
you might join humanity.
What a terrible thing that would be.
Oh, yes. Hey, Laurel O'Gorman, it's really nice talking to you. You have a great blog spot, and thank you for fighting back. We really appreciate talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Phil, as a postscript, we learned that Virtuocracy will net you 517 hits on Google.
It will.
It will. Yeah. And although I'm sure a month ago it wouldn't have landed you one.
Right. No, I mean, you must have noticed this, eh, Phil.
Oh,
I mean,
that
the actually all these guys are very lazy. That you notice. I mean, I would, if I was, you know, the editor down there, I'd say, can't you write something a little original? I mean, mostly she quotes a number of people who are basically sort of the trendsetters in the upper crust in the on and from the far right, and they just use the same terms, and so it's what they call boilerplate, right? You got to do a column this morning. Well, you just borrow here, borrow there, borrow. You know, pretty soon, you know, they're going to be, as they say, phoning it in. Anyhow, I think we're going to be talking shortly to someone who represents those who are with David Heap at the boat is called the Tahrir, and the effort is called Canadian Boat to Gaza. And I think we may have them. I don't know. I guess it'll be in a moment. In a few moments we'll be talking to them. And I should just say that's going to be Derek O'Keefe. I want to make here's a cultural note, because we're still upset here by the grisly, barbaric workings of NATO and the murder of Gaddafi. The whole way that was carried out, I'm complaining that Amnesty now wants NATO to stay because they say, well, you know, you have to protect those civilians. Hillary Clinton said that she didn't, you know, we want him captured or killed, so she got her the second. What you have to say is she should be arrested for that. She's supposed to be an international, you know, a leader, a state spokesperson. You don't talk like that. And she should be incarcerated for encouraging people to murder people. But just a little detail that I want our listeners to remember. The African National Congress said, please, let's have a peaceful resolution. We offer our good offices. Did I say the African National Congress and the African Union? But they were waved off. No, you have no business here. And we're doing these things. Now, Africans, we know, have been targeted by this new group in Libya. They if you're an African, they get you by saying you're a Gaddafi man. Well, Nelson Mandela, I want to emphasize, is a Gaddafi man. Everybody here claims to revere him. He got a Nobel Prize, and he's honored, and everybody loves to say his name. Well, he has a grandson named Gaddafi. I bet that grandson is not really impressed with Hillary and that whole NATO exercise. So keep that in mind. They were proud that Nelson Mandela's daughter was quite proud to have her son named Gaddafi because he had helped their cause. So, you know, just a little detail. I don't know if we have the... David O'Keefe, are you there? Hello, David.
Derek, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's Derek. That's my bad, I say Derek. Hey, thanks very much for joining us. We just received, before we went on air, a letter from David Heap, and one of the first things that jumped out of that letter, I don't know if he's still incarcerated, because you're going to tell us, but it was that he was tasered. Do you know about these things? Tell us what you know about the situation of the Tahrir, the Canadian boat to Gaza.
Well, 3 days ago, a Canadian aid ship, the Tahrir, and also along with an Irish ship that were trying to break the blockade of Gaza, were hijacked in international waters in a very violent and dangerous way. In fact, the boats came close to sinking. There was a collision because they had 15 Israeli Navy and other military personnel ships and vehicles surrounding them, chasing them, and as I say, committing an act of piracy, boarding the ships and detaining them, and eventually towing them into port after nearly sinking the boats. And they held and are still holding 27 delegates, as well as a number of journalists from Ireland, Canada, and as well as international countries, including Australia, the United States, and others. In terms of the Canadians, there were three Canadian delegates on board, and we can now confirm that one of them has finally been released. That's Karen DeVito from Vancouver. She has been released to Turkey, but not before, as I say, being held incommunicado for a couple of days, and then when she did finally get to communicate with people, it was to have Canadian consular officials visit her. And in the end, just one aspect of this I wanted to highlight. Mm-hmm. The Canadian government, through Minister John Baird's office, was going along with Israel's statement that the Canadians would have to pay for their own airfare out of Israel. Mm-hmm. So they were hijacked, abducted, taken to Israel against their will, held in prison, and then told they would have to pay for a plane ticket out of there. Quite unbelievable, and the whole thing.
I think some people think that Mr. Baird would like to have been there with the Israeli boats. Wasn't there a journalist also from Democracy Now? Was she on the Tahrir?
She was on the Tahrir. There was journalists from Al Jazeera, an Egyptian journalist as well, also the journalist from Democracy Now. I do not know that she's been released. As far as I know, she is still being incarcerated. And there was an issue about Israel not treating her as a journalist, just treating her as a common, as like the other political prisoners, basically not recognizing her credentials because she was from Democracy Now.
Well, Democracy Now this morning had a program, and they did say that they had. She showed them her credentials, but they made her kneel and hold her hands over her head. So basically, they just treated her as someone that, in their eyes, is a criminal, I suppose. By the way,
yes, everyone on board was treated as a criminal, treated brutally, and as you mentioned, David Heap was tasered and also beaten and bruised, and we don't know his final condition, although we hear from him in this letter that he was able to get out of prison, that he is basically okay, as he put it, but he is limping, and he was assaulted by the Israeli forces. But I just wanted to highlight that all of this brutal treatment that they've given to the international activists and the Canadians is just a taste of what the Israeli occupation forces, you know, dish out to Palestinians in Gaza and throughout Palestine on a regular basis.
Yeah, by the way, and Derek, this is Derek O'Keefe speaking on behalf of the Canadian boat to Gaza. we have all this warm, friendly, fuzzy talk about the Arab Spring and whatnot, but the Gazans had an election and they voted for the people who are presently representing them. Why wouldn't that be the reason to open the gates and deal with them as a democracy?
Well, that was the reason for Canada to jump in and cut them off and just really ratchet up this blockade. Canada was the first Western government to cut off all aid and to support the Israeli blockade of Gaza in 2006 after the election, which, as you say, was determined to be free and fair by impartial international observers. So, you know, the first democracy in that region, the first Arab country to have a democratic election, was not Tunisia this fall. It was Palestine in 2006.
Hey, that's not the police coming for you, is it?
No. We're just off the street here. But yeah, for sure. I mean, Canada and Israel and the U.S., they've been opposed to the Arab Spring, the real Arab Spring, from the beginning. And we named our boat, the Tahrir, after the inspiring uprising in Egypt. And yeah. Both Israel and the Harper government in Canada were hoping against hope that Mubarak would be able to remain in power because he was helping to enforce the siege of Gaza. He was helping with all of their foreign policy aims in the region. So they wanted him to succeed. They wanted Ben Ali to stay in power in Tunisia. And they certainly don't want to see the spirit of the Arab Spring reach Palestine and lead to a real new intifada. I think they're terrified of that because of the central role that Palestine plays in the whole region.
Yeah. By the way, Derek, we have to say here, I think people are very impressed at the determination of the Canadian boat to Gaza people, and also of those aboard the Irish. You know, there's been so much turmoil and stress and shifting of issues in the region. There were those who thought that you folks would have to just stay out of the area or would cease your efforts, but this is pretty dramatic work on your part.
Yes, well, the decision was made in the summer after the Greek government helped to enforce the Israeli blockade by preventing the Canadian boats and 10 other boats, more than 10 other boats, from leaving on the flotilla this summer. We made a decision to organize this new flotilla, which was called the Freedom Wave to Gaza, along with the Irish boats. We made a decision to do this completely under the radar so that Israel and the Canadian government and you know, anyone else who had an interest in stopping this wouldn't be fully abreast of what was going on. And unfortunately, we weren't able to tell some of our supporters and allies exactly what was planned. But the idea was to do this as a surprise. and we're hoping we're hoping that this will just be the first wave. The name Freedom Waves, the implication is that we'll keep coming and coming. And, you know, whatever one or two countries are able to organize a boat and try to break the blockade of Gaza, they'll do so whenever they can. And we know there are many other countries that have similar initiatives that weren't able to get their boats ready for this one, but, they're working and they're raising money, and some of them are still stuck in Greece dealing with the Greek authorities. Hopefully that problem will be resolved soon if Greece can get rid of its rotten government, not just the leader, but, get rid of the whole government, because... That was really a shock and a setback, certainly for Palestine's solidarity, because Greece,
incidentally, didn't you have the impression, Derek, this is Derek O'Keefe, that I recall back when we were talking to people, as a matter of fact, I think we were speaking to Ehab Lotayev about this, that the fact that the Greek government was undergoing a crisis and was being dictated to by the major capitals in Germany and France and Britain made it more difficult for them to exercise their prerogatives as a sovereign democratic state to allow you to move in and out of their country.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't want to let Papandreou totally off the hook, but his arm was being twisted and he had a gun to his head. And obviously Israel and the U.S. and Canada and others were putting pressure on him. And we actually had a bizarre situation here in Vancouver. We did a protest where we sort of occupied the Greek consulate in town until we got a meeting with the consular official here in Vancouver for Greece. And he finally met with us and he straight up told us that the reason this was being done, that Greece had to go along with Israel, is that Israel had a pipeline deal to bring natural gas, which is newly discovered in Israel, to Greece, so that Israel would be a supplier of energy, and they would do this at a reduced rate if Greece would go along with their policies of occupation and blockade. So he straight up admitted that it was a financial and economic capitulation on behalf of Greece.
So it was more bribery than threat.
yeah, for sure.
And this is Derek O'Keefe. Could you stress for us again? I mean, this matter that was this happened in international waters. There seems to be a kind of casual attitude taken towards the stopping of a ship in international waters. That's a big deal when people start boarding governments board ships in waters that are not theirs.
I don't understand it, and I don't understand the double standard of the world media when desperate former Somali fishermen board boats to, you know, they're called pirates, and it's a media sensation, the issue of Somali piracy in the waters down there. But Israel does this just openly, and when they could easily wait until we got into Gazan waters, which they claim is their own. But it's just sort of an extra arrogance that this state and the Netanyahu government so constantly display, that they were something like 30 some miles into international waters when they intercepted these ships. And of course the massacre on the Mavi Marmara last year, that was also done in international waters. So
yes, leading into the deaths of 9 individuals.
Very, very serious stuff. And you know, if countries started to if other countries started to act this way in international waters, massacring people and abducting people, you know, we'd soon be a world beset by even more conflagrations and war. Because,
well, certainly sovereign states,
these are the types of incidents that start wars.
You know,
if you hijack, and this is a Canadian ship hijacked by Israel, and yet we get zero response from the Canadian foreign minister, other than to ask us to pay our own airfare to get our people out of there.
Yeah. Amazing. By the way, a truly sovereign country would ask that country that is interfering with its civilians on a commercial or a non-military ship, they would ask, can you give us your legal reasoning for doing this? Because it's important to Canadian ships to be able to move around the world in international waters without being hindered.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the Canadian government just throws its sovereignty and self-respect away when it doesn't put the pressure on the Israelis.
Yeah, and I would just say to your listeners, we do have an action we're asking people to take today. We've actually put out a press release calling for John Baird to resign. We think that's the least he can do, and we don't have any illusions that Harper would fire him, because they all agree on his course. But we're calling for people to take action, to call the Foreign Affairs Emergency Hotline. And we have a number of other things that you can do to help the detainees that are still being held for Israel. So I'd just ask your listeners to go to the website tahrir.ca, tahrir.ca, and you can see all the latest. We've got statements going up every half hour, and news is being posted there as well. So people can see mm-hmm. how they can help, whether it's an email, a phone call, mm-hmm. or joining a protest as they take place across Canada.
It's tahrir.ca.
Yes.
Tahrir.ca. What would your expectation be? If you say that now David Heap, of course, that's the name we know here in Toronto so well because of the family and all the things they've done over the years, outstanding people in working for peace and for labor, et cetera. Would you anticipate that he is now leaving Israel, or have they cleared Israeli space, or are they still there?
I haven't seen confirmation on either Ihab Latayef or David Heap as to their release, mm-hmm. but we were hearing various reports that they would be let out today or tomorrow. But the whole issue of where they'll be deported to and who will pay for it mm-hmm. is still being disputed. And, of course, we're fighting very hard not to have anyone have to pay to get out of an Israeli prison.
No.
It's outrageous. So,
well,
so
the Israelis are the ones who took them on international yeah. waters. So,
I cannot confirm about David Heap and Ihab Latayef at this time, but we will post that information as soon as we know. And another thing we're asking people to do is to organize welcome back when they do finally
Absolutely.
Get out, and if possible, to meet them at the airport and to show our support there.
Terrific. No, that's great. I mean, I think there are thousands of Canadians would like to do that and would look forward to seeing them It is, as far as I think, a moment of great pride to Canadians who want to see peace and justice done in the Middle East. So, and it all turns on Tahrir.ca. So, Derek, we're very grateful that you took the time to talk to us. Thanks very much.
Sure. Let me just say there is a protest today at the Israeli outside the Israeli consulate in Toronto at 5 p.m. So pretty much that's already underway. But
yeah,
in your time,
asking,
if anyone's listening and can get over there,
as soon as
it would just still be worth doing.
All right. Well, good for them and good for you. And we hope we can talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye bye. Derek O'Keefe, Tahrir.ca, David Heap, we think. Is released, and we think he'd be on his way. And he was tasered. I want the Toronto Star to know that. He said he was tasered. If you don't think he was tasered, I want the Toronto Star to explain how they would not think he was tasered. But he says he was tasered. I'm going to take his word for it.
You know, this is an interesting little twist. The Israelis always go one step further. But to deport somebody and say, by the way, you have to pay for your own deportation. I mean, first of all, those people didn't ask
We've
to go to jail.
We've heard stories about the people have to pay for the rope when they hang them.
That's right.
I mean, that's the same mental area that thinking comes
from. Very much so. I mean, these people were on a boat to Gaza, right? I mean, the Israelis could deliver them to Gaza. You know, they can get home from there. That was their destination, right? Mm-hmm. But the Israelis to say, well, we're going to send you someplace else in the world, and we're going to make you pay us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's even by standards of ruling-class cynicism, that's really something special.
This is called playing to your base.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people who say, you know, that I want you to taser him or I want you to hurt him, you know, and indicate to me that you are doing that. So, yeah, pay for it. Yes, of course. What I think, you know, what would have been reasonable? If you don't, okay, put them back on their boat and tell them to go away. Make them sail home. You know, that's but by the way, in international waters...
the word is piracy, right? I mean, isn't piracy the right word to describe
boarding
a ship in international waters and seizing control of a ship over which you have no rights, right? And that's what pirates do.
That is, except that this is a government.
Yeah.
And so it's another word for it is an act of war. I mean, you know, we've all heard of the Barbary pirates and the shores of Tripoli. If you ask me, I can sing the song from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Why did they go there? They went there because their ships were being interfered with, and they said, that's war. I mean, we're going to come to you, the commander in Tripoli, and we're going to remove you for attacking us because we're just going up and down in our ships. So, that's a very... In history, many, many wars, that's how they started.
Well, the War of 1812, which Harper wants to make a big show about, right? I mean... Didn't that start with the British interfering with American shipping? They said, you know, the little upstarts, and we're going
to... Well, there was a man in... to know. There was a man in Upper Canada who was elected, one of the few people who was actually elected. His name was Wilcox. And he wrote to his friends in the United States, and he said, you know, they have removed... The British have removed 6,000 sailors from American ships to put into the British Navy... And you just take that. He said, you're not a country. If you don't defend yourself against that kind of aggression. So that was somebody in Upper Canada. He was saying, look, if you're a sovereign country, why do you tolerate that? Well, by the way, a question that resonates. But no, of course, it's as old. And incidentally, during the Civil War, the British went out of their minds. But when two Confederate delegates were in the Caribbean... And they were traveling to Britain to present their credentials as ambassadors of the slave states. And the British were happy to have them on that boat. An American boat stopped the boat and said, these two guys are criminals. We're taking them off your boat. Every British newspaper called for war. They said, oh, no, you do not remove. And those were American. They weren't British. They said, you don't take anybody off a British boat. We go to war with you. That's what they said. And it took a lot of, and everybody said that was the error. The error was on Lincoln's part. He was the guy, the bad guy. Actually, it all got resolved because they said, well, of course, the captain made his own decision on the scene, and the appropriate resolution of that conflict, they said, was to take the boat into a port and go in front of a judge and explain what you have done. and then he determines whether you can do that. But they didn't do that. Instead, because he was being polite and letting the ship go on, he simply took the two criminals. These are guys who represented the Confederacy, and I know 4 million Americans who know they were criminals, because those 4 million were slaves. They, at any rate, the representatives were taken off the boat. So, by the way, Lincoln ended up letting them go to England. Go ahead, go. but yeah, stopping a boat is big stuff. And don't think that we're not going to have to war over this. The Americans are sailing around the Persian Gulf like they own it, and they do run up to you, by the way. Warships, they play. They run right up to you so that you'll know they're there. And they, you know, can make you sweat. And they stalked a Chinese ship once in the Persian Gulf. Stalked it. I mean, just went along in its wake, bothering it. And now the Navy is harassing ships in and around China. And America has raised a big question. They said, China has launched an aircraft carrier. And they said, they didn't explain to us why they need an aircraft carrier. Did somebody aboard your aircraft carrier notice that they had an aircraft carrier? And by the way, where are you sailing? Off the Chinese coast. Yeah, this is goofy stuff. I have, by the way, you mentioned the War of 1812, and there is an issue. I want to help Mr. Coyle. He wrote a column for the Toronto Star about the Battle of Tippecanoe. And I don't mind it. It was sort of an odd story. He's trying to trace the origins of the War of 1812 to the attack on Prophetstown by the Governor Harrison of Indiana. And he says that the natives attacked Harrison's forces, and they did it because they had been told that they were invulnerable and the bullets of the Americans wouldn't harm them because the prophet had told them that he gave them magical powers. To me, that, by the way, can be refuted by reading Mr. Coyle's own column. They made an attack at night when the Americans, they thought, might be, it was like smart attack, a night attack. If they thought that they had magical powers, why attack at night? If the bullets aren't going to harm you, you may as well attack in broad daylight, have lunch, then go over and attack. So, in other words, it's just silly, and it infantilizes the Native Americans. Those guys are veteran fighters. They've seen a lot of bodies. They knew what bullets did. So to tell us this little fairy tale, it's insult. To me, it's an insult to the Native Americans, and it mischaracterizes what happened. So anyhow, that's a story for another day. Hey, Phil, we got to tell some people there's a show coming up.
Right. Being There, which is a veteran show on CIUT, has a new slot, 6 p.m., following the Taylor Report with Jesse Mendez. It's up next.
It's going to be coming up. And I think we are almost at the finish line. We want to thank Laurel of miss-marks.blogspot.com.
That's it.
And Derek O'Keefe of Canadian Boat to Gaza. And we really hope we can...
Tahrir.ca,
Tahrir.ca. And let's hear it for them. And we hope that we'll all go out there and greet David Heap and his friends when they get back. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. I want to thank Ethan and Phil Conlon. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.fm, and check us out, Taylor-Report.com. We'll see you next week.